star. Makes no difference who you are. Anything your heart desires will come to you. If your heart is in your dream, no request is too extreme. When you wish upon a star, as dreamers do. Like a boat out of the blue, fate steps in and sees you through. When you wish upon a star, your dreams come.
This is Richard Roth with The Passage on WGXC, and that was Cliff Edwards as Jiminy Cricket in Walt Disney's Pinocchio, singing one of the top hits of 1940, the year my guest was born. Michael Lindsay Hogg has a show of his paintings and drawings at BCB Art this month. He also was at Basilica Hudson last weekend for a screening of his Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus, and to sign copies of his memoir, Luck and Circumstance. This is the second part of a two-part interview. After the interview, the Rolling Stones with Painted Black as recorded live on Ready, Steady, Go, a British television show Mr. Lindsay Hogg directed in the 1960s.
It's Richard Roth. I'm in the studio with Sir Michael Lindsay Hogg, continuing a conversation about his work as an author and videographer and director and painter, most relevant because he's going to be having a show at BCB Art on Warren Street in Hudson. Michael, welcome.
Thanks, Richard.
So, shall we start with Let It Be?
Sure. When I was preparing the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus, I got a call from Paul McCartney asking if I'd come and talk to them about a kind of vague idea they had for doing a television special. And so I went over, and they were all there. And the genesis of the special came from a video promotion film we'd done earlier in the year for Revolution and Hey Jude. We shot Hey Jude in about six takes. And between takes, while the cameramen were repositioning and the videotape reels were being reloaded, the Beatles were just standing on their rostrum, and we'd imported an audience of about 100 people to carry the song on that long last four-minute chorus. And so in the first break, the Beatles just stood there and had a smoke. And then in the second break, they thought, well, there's 100 people there. Maybe we should do something. Their instincts, I guess, from the time they'd been in Hamburg and at the Cavern Club kicked in. And they started to play. There'd be about 7 or 8 minutes between takes, and they'd do some of their songs, and they'd do some Tamla Motown songs. And at first, they were kind of listless and felt, well, we ought to do it. But then by the time we were through and getting to take six, they were really starting to enjoy it. And they hadn't played to any kind of public since they'd stopped touring 2 years before. So as a result of this feeling they had that maybe they could go out and do something again, McCartney had an idea to do a television special. It wasn't really clear what it would be, but they just wanted to do it, or he wanted to do it, and they were on the bus with him. Although it seemed early on that maybe a couple of them wanted to get off the bus, but he was the driver at that time. So we started just after the new year in 1969 at Twickenham Film Studios. We were there. It was a big, cold, sort of barn of a studio, which probably wasn't the right place, but we were there for about 10 days. And it wasn't going that well. They weren't used to being filmed. They'd never been filmed rehearsing before. I suppose they trusted me because I'd worked with them on Paperback Writer in Rain and Hey Jude and Revolution. So we had two cameras running during rehearsals, which were sometimes fractious. They changed a lot from their early, very collaborative days. It was much more that one of them would write a song and come in and demo it for the others, and then they'd all sort of play their part. But after about 10 days, George Harrison wasn't happy with the way things were going, and he quit. And he only came back after 3 or 4 days if we'd agreed to move to their own small recording studio at Apple in Savile Row in London. They owned a building on Savile Row, which is a street mainly known for fancy tailors. And in the building was, at the basement, they'd had someone build a studio for them so they could work. They could basically come into the building, record, go upstairs, have lunch, have meetings, go down and record again. So it was self-contained. And so we moved to Apple, and all talk of a television special was sidelined. And that was disappointing to me because between us, we'd had some ideas which really might have worked and made for a wonderful hour or 2 hours of entertainment with the songs they were coming up with. Anyway, I was worried that the stuff we'd been shooting, which was them rehearsing but also talking and interacting, mightn't find a home. It was originally meant just to be a little half-hour documentary before the TV special, which is McCartney's idea that we film the rehearsal because the main focus was on the TV special, but when George said he didn't want to do it, then the TV special went down the drain. It had an idea. The idea which gained the most currency was that I'd heard of an amphitheater on the coast of Tunisia, and it was a kind of melting pot in the world. There was a American service base nearby. There were citizens of many countries nearby, black, white, brown, from everywhere. And I had the idea that the Beatles would start tuning up at dawn. And then as they played, the music would go out across the desert and one by one and two by two and four by four, sort of like a ambulatory Noah's Ark, people would come toward the music. And so by midnight, when they were doing Long and Winding Road or Let It Be, the amphitheater would be filled basically by the world. So that was the idea. So it wasn't scripted as much as an idea. But anyway, that went down the drain, and we were at Apple in Savile Row in London in that cold January of 1969, and I was getting worried that the stuff I'd been shooting would never be seen by anyone, and I knew there was good stuff. I knew there was good music. I knew there was good ways of learning for the audience about how they worked with each other and also about the way they had conversations with each other and also the way they played other songs. They didn't only play their own songs. They'd play songs by other performers just to get them in the groove. One day we were having lunch in the boardroom, which doubled as a dining room, two floors up from this recording studio. Lunch in those days was quite a fancy affair. It was cooked by some trainee young women who were cooks in the Apple kitchen. And then they'd bring it to the dining table, where there'd be the four of the Beatles, there'd be Yoko, there'd be me, there'd be our cameraman, Tony Richmond, and whoever else was around. And it would be, you know, roast chicken or lamb cutlets and peas and spinach and potatoes and red wine and white wine and macrobiotic for John and Yoko. So it was quite a fancy affair. I remember saying to them, listen, you wouldn't go to Tunisia, but we need something to conclude this with. Whatever it is we're doing, we need to have something that we're aiming at. And they said, oh, yeah, okay, what? And so I said, well, I had an idea. I felt a bit like Mickey Rooney in those old movies, you know, hey, kids, this is a swell barn. We can put the show on right here. And I said, well, why don't we do it on the roof? And McCartney said, what? And I said, a concert. And they said, oh. And they sort of chewed over this idea for the rest of lunch. And then after lunch, Paul and Ringo and Tony the cameraman and Ethan Russell, the stills photographer, we went up on the roof and thought, well, this could work. We looked out over all of London. And so Paul said, well, go ahead and get it cooking, and I'll talk to the others and see what they feel about it. Well, he didn't. It was an idea which everyone knew was floating around because they'd been at the lunch, but they didn't make any firm decision. On the Thursday, I had the 11 cameras ready to shoot, and we'd also built a two-way mirror in the lobby in case the police came to stop the concert, which we thought they probably would if we ever did a concert. The noise and probably complaints from local businesses, because this was they were the Beatles. They were the most famous four people in the world, but still it was an uptight time in those kind of staid and fancy areas of London. So the weather was bad, and then again the 11 cameras were set up on the following day, the Friday. We found ourselves, the four of them and Yoko and me, at about noon in a little room beneath the roof. And I realized that the idea was not solid, even though we had the 11 cameras and we had all the crews and we were ready to go, because George said, what's the point? You know, why do we have to do this again? Let's record the music in the studio. Ringo said, yeah, and it's going to be cold up there. And it was cold. And then Paul said, come on, fellas, let's just do something. Because he wanted to keep them together, and he felt unless he could organize them to do something as a group, they might fall apart, which indeed they did about a year later. So it was Paul against George and Ringo. If I can put it like that, there were many more sort of subtle interplays between them than just saying Paul against George and Ringo, but that's the shorthand way of putting it. But one voice had not been heard from, and that was John Lennon. And everyone sort of looked at him, and he said, let's do it. And so it was John and Paul, and when they voted yes, basically the others would do what they wanted. So the Beatles walked up the little staircase onto the roof and into history, because that concert was the last time they performed to any kind of public. So we really did get the last performance by the Beatles, which was lucky and extraordinary, really. And while they were up there, they were very happy. They really connected, the four of them, playing music to some kind of crowd, even though they were down on the street, you know, four stories down. They really rocked and rolled, and it's great to see. And I hope when Apple re-releases Let It Be, which I think will be in about 18 months, everyone will feel as I do that it was a great occasion. And then the weirdest thing, when it was over, John Lennon stepped to the microphone and said, thank you on behalf of ourselves and the group, and I hope we pass the audition. And, of course, if any four musicians or any four artists ever passed any kind of audition, it was them.
In those days, was Yoko an active part of the group?
She was present. She always was sitting beside John. She never weighed in with any opinions about the music in public. I mean, she just sat there doing whatever she's doing, drawing or reading something or that. If she did privately, I don't know. And many people have, I think, felt or criticized the fact that she was around so much as leading to the Beatles' breakup, but that's not the case at all. They all were on their way to going their separate ways. They hadn't performed for 2 years, and that's usually what keeps rock and roll bands together, just because they are together. You know, they're in Minneapolis one night, they're in Chicago the next night, they're traveling, and the songwriters are usually working together. The Rolling Stones have been together for God knows 50 years. But the Beatles were living at that point very separate lives. Paul had met Linda Eastman, who was his first wife, and they were living a very regular life. Linda had a child by a previous relationship, and Paul looked after her. And Paul likes domestic life. He likes dinner being on the table at the same time, and he likes getting involved with the children's education and stuff like that. He's a kind of traditional dad in that sense. Whereas John was wanting, I think, really to follow a more bohemian life. And that's what he got with Yoko, who had been a very well-regarded artist in New York in the late 50s, even before she went to London. And so she wasn't just some, you know, Japanese groupie who attached herself to John. She was an artist in her own right. And I think that's what appealed to him as much as her beauty and her intelligence. And she was, as a young woman, beautiful, and she was very intelligent. And so they were going one way. Paul was going another way. George was about to go his own way because I think he was frustrated by the setup to do with the albums. That if there were, say, 12 tracks, Lennon-McCartney would be 9, George would maybe be 2, there might be 1 for Ringo. But he felt, as an artist, that he was undervalued, both probably to do with his what people thought of his work, because he didn't hear that much of it, and also financially, because he was getting less of a cut of the albums. And he very soon went out on his own and became, you know, the singular musician and songwriter that he became. So they all were about to go different ways, and so Yoko was there all the time. And even when we did the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus, which we'd done in December of 68, before we started to do the Beatles in 69, John Lennon plays with Eric Clapton and Keith Richards and Mitch Mitchell of the Hendrix Experience. And then after they'd done one song, then Yoko gets out of a black bag and sings for 5 minutes. Her singing is a weird thing anyway. It's kind of an ululation of sound rather than what we call singing, but it's very memorable, piercingly memorable. I think Let It Be is just under an hour and a half. It's either an hour and 20 or an hour and 30. And I think the plan is, when it does see the light of day again, that the Let It Be movie will be released. And then to accompany the film, I think there's going to be a auxiliary documentary about the making of the documentary, which I'm pleased about, because there's a lot of things which were cut out of the original Let It Be, which are in the documentary about the making of Let It Be. And so a lot of the stuff which is out is now back in, and so you really do get the whole egg. And the auxiliary documentary has been very interestingly and well put together by marrying current interviews with people who remember what was going on with old footage and intercut between, I'll say, and then I remember John said, and then you cut to John actually saying it, you know. So it's been quite artfully put together. And so that's the plan, and I think Apple will release it. They've been very diligently releasing all the Beatles film stuff, you know, sort of step by step and almost chronologically. And so I guess Let It Be will be the last one.
So you were doing these films, and then you were also doing dramatic films of various kinds.
It was a funny period. I was living in England at the time, even though I took a year out to come to work in Hollywood and try to make a movie there, which didn't get made. I was doing dramatic English television, which was after I'd done some apprentice dramatic work. It was a good period for English television, not so much for English movies, because there wasn't much English movies. And so all the good writers were writing for television. That is, when they went writing for the theater, like I did Tom Stoppard's only television play because it was something he wanted to write about. There was no funding for it as a movie, and so we did it for the BBC. And there was very, very high-quality work on television then because you had very high-quality writers. All the, you know, the cream of the crop of writing for English television. And so that was good to do. And then was asked to direct Brideshead Revisited, which was was from Evelyn Waugh's great novel. So we prepared it about 8 months, and then I shot for 5 months. And then there was a strike which shut down production for several months. The technicians union went on strike, and all the television was off the air. Not only were you not making it, they weren't screening anything. And then I was supposed to go and do a movie, and I would have finished Brideshead by the time the movie was going to go if it hadn't been for the strike, and then I had to leave Brideshead, which was sad. And then the next director came in, and I think he shot like 8 months. But I spent basically a year preparing and shooting 5 months. So we take, because I'm very proud of the actors that are in Brideshead, because he'd done a bit before, but we basically put Jeremy Irons on the map, and Anthony Andrews and Simon Jones and Phoebe Nichols and Nicholas Grace, who are the wonderful group of young English actors at the time, and the actor is what makes the character. I mean, you can put someone in the clothes and wearing the hat, but if you get the wrong actor, it doesn't matter. But if you get the right actor, it enriches the thing no end. The only one which had really, as a series, got the attention beforehand was the one created by the two actresses, Jean Marsh and Eileen Atkins, which was Upstairs, Downstairs, which is certainly the parents of Downton Abbey, because Downton Abbey is really Upstairs, Downstairs, with slightly more melodramatic scripts and more money to put on production. But Upstairs, Downstairs was the forerunner.
And then how did you come to be involved with The Normal Heart?
The Normal Heart, yes. I'd done a play in London in the late 1970s called Whose Life Is It Anyway? And that transferred to Broadway with Tom Conti playing the leading character. He won a Tony for that. And then a couple of years later on Broadway, I did Agnes of God with Geraldine Page and Amanda Plummer and Liz Ashley. And that did well, and Amanda won the Tony for that. So I'd had a little, and I'd worked in the theater before, but those ones had done well enough that I was sort of considered working as a theater director, too. I'd known Larry Kramer, who wrote The Normal Heart, since we both were in England in the late 1960s. In fact, he came to an early preview screening of Let It Be and weighed in with his comments, both good and bad. But I'd known him, and I'd always liked him and admired him and liked being in his company very much. I was up in in Toronto doing a television version, a television movie, of Athol Fugard's Master Harold and the Boys with Matthew Broderick and Zakes Mukai and John Connie. And the phone rang in where I was staying, and a brusque voice said, "It's Larry Kramer, and I have a play I want you to read." "Sure, send me a play." So then the next day arrived an envelope with numberless pages, it seemed to me, and it was thick. And so I waded through it, and then I thought, ooh, there really is something here. It wasn't like a rapier. It was like a bludgeon. It was extremely powerful, not delicate, but if it were done well, I thought it would have great weight and great value. And it was about AIDS. And at that time, 1984, 1985, and on, AIDS was just coming to be known in the society. But Larry was outraged that it wasn't being given any attention or any money by any political body, or that the main newspaper of the country at the time, the New York Times, wasn't paying any attention to it. I think he said that when the Tylenol poison scare came, I think a couple of capsules, someone had tampered with the Tylenol bottle, and I think two people might have died from bad pills. That was on page one of the New York Times, and it wasn't until you turned to page 32 that this was a little article about something which was being called the gay cancer. And he, by that time, had known many of his friends who died, and he was sure that the reason that the New York City government, the federal government, and the press was paying so little attention to it was because of either blatant homophobia or submerged homophobia. And so Larry was determined to do something about this. He wrote the play. what he didn't tell me when we met a couple of weeks later was that it had been turned down by everybody. It had gone to producers who didn't want to do it. It had gone to other directors who didn't want to do it. And so I was, I guess, the last resort. I don't know if he had other plays produced. I think he was nominated for an Oscar for the screenplay of Ken Russell's movie Women in Love, for his screenplay. He had written then, before The Normal Heart, he'd written a book called Faggot, which has its devotees, but he talked about a lot of people that he knew and barely disguised their names, and so he had annoyed a lot of people too. So he was a writer, and I think he might have had a play put on, but nothing caught the attention in the way that The Normal Heart was going to do. But no one wanted to do it. Management wanted to do it. They were afraid that you would have no audience who'd want to see a play about AIDS. And because as it was getting into what you might call the straight community, everyone was starting to get really alarmed by it. And because in that period, if you weren't educated, you didn't know how you were getting it. I think there was a national magazine which had a cover saying, "Can you get AIDS from tears? Can you get it if you use the same coffee spoon as someone else?" It was a great deal of ignorance and a great deal of fear. And then it had been sitting with Joe Papp at the Public Theater, very much pushed forward by Joe's wife, Gail Merriweather. But they didn't have a director, and it was a very unwieldy play, just because it was long and had some repetitions and stuff like that, because Larry just wrote from his heart, and he didn't edited at that time. But then Joe and I met, and although we didn't at first, I don't think we particularly hit it off, at least there was a director who wanted to do the play. He and I eventually became friends. He's a wonderful man. And he said, "Okay, I'll do it." And then sometime later, so he was the only producer brave enough to take on this subject. Come hell or high water, if it's going to get an audience, who's going to get an audience? If it played to empty theaters, who's going to put it on and let what happened happen? He said to me, it was interesting that as we were rehearsing The Normal Heart, there was another play running at the Public, which had been created by a bunch of Vietnam vets. I think they were called Vetco. And it was about their experience in Vietnam. And he said to me, it just dawned on me one day that in two of my theaters, I have plays about men at war. One was about Vietnam, one was about AIDS. So he was the guy. And then we cast it with an extraordinary bunch of actors, gay and straight, a kind of mixed bag. Some actors were scared to do it because they were afraid, you know, if they were seen playing a gay part, if they were straight, it would make it hard for them to get work. It turned out, of course, to be just the opposite, because good work is good work and people recognize that. So we rehearsed it. It got canceled once or twice, I think. Once because there was insinuations in the play that the then mayor of New York, Ed Koch, was gay, and that was why he wasn't paying more attention to AIDS. And then City Hall got in touch with Joe and said, "You have to take that reference out." And Joe said, "Well, go screw yourself, I'm not going to do it." And then they said, "We'll sue you or we'll close down your theater." And so we got a call in rehearsal one day, and Larry took it, and then very dramatically he hung up the phone and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, The Normal Heart is canceled." We got back on our feet because Joe was a great political player as well as a wonderfully stalwart producer. So we started, we rehearsed it, which was thrilling. One of the things which is interesting about The Normal Heart is that any of us who were involved in the original production, when the times were very, very different to what they are now in terms of AIDS, in terms of knowledge, in terms of outreach, in terms of funding, in terms of medicine, in terms of treatment, really became friends for life. It was a very testing experience for all of us. But, of course, as a director, as an actor, if you have a play of real quality, you never forget that, whether it's The Normal Heart or if it's Hamlet.
How large was the company?
There were, I think we had eight, there were eight or nine. One woman who played a doctor, and the rest were men. One of the characters was meant to be straight, and the other characters were gay. And then, you know, life sometimes taking the horrid choices that it does. Three of the guys who were in the original production, including my dear friend Brad Davis, died of AIDS. And then we started to preview it for several weeks. Joe didn't want to open it until it was ready, and he knew we wouldn't know if it was ready until we showed it to an audience. We rehearsed about a month, and then we rehearsed in a warehouse or in a rehearsal loft. And then we moved into the public, into the Lou Ester Theater, which was a kind of funny little space upstairs. It held about, I guess, about 300 people. And for the first 3 weeks, I'd say, of previews, our audience was only made up of men. Men on their own or men with their significant others. And they were an extraordinary audience because what they were seeing on the stage was what they were living in their own lives, and they were thrilled in one way that it was being spoken about and it wasn't being pushed under the carpet with the kind of homophobic thing of, well, if we don't talk about it, it doesn't exist. And so they saw their own lives and they were grateful. They were a very, very passionate audience because by this time the play had been slimmed down a bit by Larry, seeing how things were going in rehearsal, and he was also assisted by a wonderful guy called Bill Hart, who worked at the public, and he and Larry, after rehearsal, every night would go off and have a sandwich and start to work on shaping the play. Whereas my job was really then the next day to see what they'd done the night before and then work with the actors to try to figure out what was the best way to present the constantly changing play. Then we opened, and we basically got kind of very, very, very good, slightly confused reviews. They didn't know what it was, because it was a very atypical play for America at that time, because it was really taking on the city government, the federal government, the New York Times. It was looking for a fight. And it wasn't a soft drama or a predictably domestic drama with a few tears. It was looking for a fight, and that's what Larry was very, very glad to provide. And then we began to get what you might call mixed audiences, and then we transferred from one theater to another at the public, a larger theater, and it then became the Normal Heart. The first production at the public theater became the longest running play to stay at the public. I think we ran for 11 months. So it was a great achievement. It was then played all over the world, not our production, but other productions. Then there was a successful revival a couple of years ago in New York. And then earlier this year, HBO did a film version with Mark Ruffalo, who's a wonderful actor, playing the part that Brad had originated. And of course, life has changed, because that's almost 30 years ago now that we did it. And once a week, we'd have a team of doctors come and talk to the actors in the company about what the prognosis was for AIDS treatment and stuff. And at that time, there was no prognosis. Everyone was mystified. They had a good idea of how it could be go from one person to another, because there was starting then to be lots of AIDS in Africa, heterosexual AIDS. But there was no good news. And so we'd listen to and ask questions of the doctors. Then, you know, we'd go off feeling glum because it was bad. And it was bad for so many people. But now, of course, things have changed. I mean, first of all, society has changed a lot. And what's the weirdest thing is at the end of The Normal Heart, Larry had written a scene which we all thought was something like out of a demented fairy tale, that the leading character's lover is dying in hospital, and he wants to marry him. And he gets the woman doctor to become a minister for the occasion. And she, in the hospital bed, marries the man in the bed and his lover. And we all kind of ribbed Larry, like, okay, if you want to have a marriage between two men, you know, write it, man, it's very sweet. It was an impossibility of an idea when we did it. And now, of course, thank God, society has changed in so many ways. And I mean, it's quite interesting now in New York that 30 years ago, producers were very worried about doing a play with a gay theme. And now, I would say half of what's on Broadway is probably has a gay theme. So things move on, you know, they take a while, but they do.
Meanwhile, all this time, were you also doing visual art?
Yeah. For some reason, I wasn't directing as much as I wanted to do. I wrote and directed a movie with John Malkovich and Andy McDowell called The Object of Beauty. Then I did another one called Frankie Starlight, shot in Ireland, then another one called Guy. The Object of Beauty did quite well, and the others were okay, but they didn't help my career in that sense. I was offered other things, but I didn't want to do it, and I'd saved up a bit of money. And I have scripts of my own. There's one that's almost been made twice. And I got spoiled in England by working with good writers. And so I don't want to spend my time doing something which I really have to drag myself out of bed to do it if I don't have to. So then all my life I've drawn, partly because when I was a little boy, I couldn't read till I was nine. And the way that I could sort of communicate with myself was by drawing. And I also like comic books very much because they tell their story panel to panel. And you know if it's a close-up in a panel that something serious is going on. And if you then have that panel, which is outside a building with the bubbles with dialogue coming out, it's not quite so serious. So I love comic books, and I've always drawn. But then and doodled. Then I put that aside when the directing started working. And then about 15 years ago, my wife said to me, "Will you draw? Have you ever thought of painting?" And I said, "Well, that's not what I do." She said, "Well, why don't we just go and get some oils and see if it's what you do?" And so then I began to paint. I'm self-taught. I've never had a lesson, but my eye is good, you know, because I've been around. I've been in museums and seen pictures and photographs and things like that. And I think some of them are really pretty interesting. But then in the middle of that, I wrote my memoir, Luck and Circumstance, which is quite a good read. You've read it.
I've read it. I enjoyed it very much. I recommended it to my doctor yesterday.
Really?
Yes.
I hope he reads it. I think you can get it is this called The Spotty Dog?
That's right, yes.
In Hudson. But then the painting started to take off. We have a garage where I live, and I sort of, it's a terrible mess. My wife won't go in there. But I started really painting with a vengeance, and I had a show in Los Angeles 2 years ago, which did quite well. I mean, we sold a lot, because what I do is there's paintings in oil, and there's drawings, lots of drawings, because I still draw a lot, because that's my communication tool. And then I think in a funny way, when I looked at some of the drawings, they're sort of like, it's kind of like writing with a line or writing in color, because I usually do people who are having some kind of exchange with each other, but you don't know how it's going to turn out. And sometimes I have dialogue on the drawing, but on the paintings I don't have dialogue, but it's still, what interests me is people and faces and a kind of tension that you know something's going on but you can't put your finger on it, and that's what I like. I like the kind of sense of ambiguity about it. So the paintings, yeah, BCB Art, and I think it opens August the 9th at 116 Warren Street in Hudson. It'll be up for a month. I think my paintings with people in them are more interesting than my paintings of a bowl of fruit would be. Although sometimes I have other bits and pieces in the paintings, like flowers and things like that, but it really is, what's always interested me most is the human being. And I guess that's why I like directing. I guess that's why I like trying to make characters come alive, whether it's on stage or on film or on a canvas. because human beings are endlessly interesting and have such a variety of stories, some of which they tell you up front and some of which are hidden, and some of which you have to search for, and some of which you find, and some of which they won't release. And I like the sense of that kind of mystery, if I can use a kind of grand word, in the paintings. You don't quite know what's going on.
How did it happen that you didn't learn to read until so late?
I don't know. I mean, my mother thinks it was a version of dyslexia. It foxed me. And it wasn't until we were in Ireland one summer, and because we used to go every other year for my mother to see, my mother was Irish, for her to see her mother and father, and for me to see my father, who also was Irish, my mother and he were divorced. When we were over there, when I was, just before I was nine, I was 8 and a half, I'd been to remedial lessons at school, and they always didn't do me any good, because I think people thought you were stupid then if you couldn't read. Of course, education has changed, attitudes have changed. But there was I was staying with my uncle, and near where he lived was a little old lady with white hair done in a bun and truly a kind of long granny dress, and she wore high-heeled little boots. She probably was 80. And she was extraordinarily gentle and kind, and I wasn't scared of her. And she's the one who somehow got me to connect the symbol, which is the letter connected to the next symbol, which form a sound and form a word. And she basically taught me to read almost from scratch, because I couldn't understand it. Now, there may be something wrong in my brain, too, because I don't drive. I have driven, but it wasn't a success. And I think basically, if I signal, if I put out a signal for a right turn, I'll probably turn left. And then when I was a kid playing baseball, if I was in the batter's box and the pitch would come at my head, rather than pull away, I'd lean into it. So there's something a little bit backwards in my reflexes. So it's good I don't drive. It's good I read now. But it was a bedeviling thing when I was young, because also I decided, or I didn't decide, it happened. I also got very fat. And so I was a fat kid who was bullied a lot, who couldn't read, and who wanted to be a baseball player. And I had a funny upbringing. I was mainly because my mother was an actress, and so I didn't see her much when we were living in California, because she was the breadwinner, and she was always working. And the only time I'd really see her was when she would refuse a part in one of the Warner Brothers pictures and be put in suspension, and then she'd be home a lot. But then after a while, she couldn't afford to be in suspension because she was the breadwinner, and then she'd go back and have to take the part she turned down, or a worse part because they wanted to punish her. I was really brought up by sort of a nurse who's a wonderfully bigoted Irish Catholic. I remember when I was 8 years old, she tucked me in bed at night, and she'd give me milk and ginger snaps, and she brushed my hair back from my head, and she said, don't worry, you'll be all right. And I thought, well, who won't be all right? And she said, your mother and father, they'll go to hell, but you'll be all right. And I said, well, why are they going to go to hell? And she said, because they're divorced. So I had a kind of lots of mixed signals as a kid. But then, I'll tell you what, if you're different in any way, especially in those years, it's a bit sink or swim, but it also does teach you a kind of resilience that I found those years between 8 and 16, which is when I had my first job in the theater, not what I'd like to repeat. I found it hard. But it makes you tougher. I mean, there are other ways to be tough, and I'd prefer that's what happened probably, but, you know, you can't make those choices.
Down here at the, I guess all the Steiner schools, including this one, they don't teach kids to read until they're 6 or 7, I think.
Really?
Yeah, it's strictly in visual expressing in visual and musical expression.
How lucky. I, of course, because of my generation, my time, I went to much more conservative schools where adventures in education was not what they were interested in. They were interested in getting kids into you know, a boarding school or getting them into a good college, and, you know, learning sports and being an all-arounder, but they were not particularly sympathetic to little weirdos.
Is there anything else we haven't talked about that we should cover?
Richard, we've done the normal heart, we've done the painting, we've done the writing, luck and circumstance, thank you for your doctor. We've done the Rolling Stones, we've done the Beatles. I think that's it. I mean, I think that's the work, and I think they all sort of, because what you asked me, and then especially wrapping up at the end, is everything is sort of flowing one to the other, which is kind of like luck and circumstance in a way, which it's not linear. In other words, like memory or conversation, it flows, it goes one way, it stops, it goes backwards, it then goes forward again, which is really the way conversation is, I think.
Did you have all the photographs in the book? Were those photos that are part of your own collection?
For the most part, or I knew how to get them. The picture of me with Mick Jagger and John Lennon in the Rock and Roll Circus was taken by a friend of mine, Ethan Russell. He let me have it for nothing. The picture of me with Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, I think I had to buy for like $300 from the photographer. The ones of Orson Welles, I had one or two. I had the ones of my mother. Another one from Orson came from some archival museum. So I had most of them. And some of them are very sweet. I mean, there's a nice one of me and my mother on the beach.
That's a lovely photograph, yeah.
On the running. Mm.
Did you make a sort of Hitchcockian appearance in the Rock and Roll Circus? I thought at one point I saw you there.
No, but I did make a Hitchcockian appearance in Let It Be. That actually wasn't all that subtle. I was asking McCartney a question, and so we cut to me because we needed a cutaway. We didn't have anything else. I mean, it was fine, you know. It's nice to be preserved in some way when I was 29 or 28. No, I was mainly in a truck or a shed that they built just to the side of the studio, where the pictures would come into monitors. Even though we were shooting on film, the pictures would come into monitors like regular television pictures, and I could communicate to the camera guys via headphones to get them to change the shot and things like that, which hadn't been done before. Because normally if you're shooting a rock and roll concert with just film, you're not completely sure what you're getting. You're trying to tell the guys what to get. That's like up in the roof and Let It Be. I was near and beside the cameraman. I'd be able to say, you go to a close-up here. But it was happening so fast, sometimes it's just what the camera guy got, and then we edited it later. And so I was mainly in this truck, you know, for 22 hours. We're going to France for a minute because there may be someone's trying to set up a show with the paintings and drawings in Paris, and we'd see about that. And then we may go to Poland. We were in Poland a couple of years ago because there's a festival nominally honoring cinematographers in Bydgoszcz in Poland called Camera Image. And I was awarded a Golden Frog for sort of inventing rock and roll videos.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I love Poland. It's great. And but for reasons best known to themselves, a Polish publisher is going to publish the memoir Luck and Circumstance in Polish. I mean, I'd thought it might go in France or Germany or somewhere like that. But no, in Poland, it's translated into Polish. I can't pronounce the title. It's a tough language, Polish. But we may have to go to Poland for a minute. Like I said, I love Poland. I've only been there once, but they're terrific. And the city's been rebuilt very beautifully after the Germans and the Russians. Then we come back here for the BCB show in August. And then there's another show in Los Angeles in the middle of September of paintings and drawings. So they're going to get seen. Hope they sell. can I get seen? You know, and part of it is, like with movies or plays, is you want the exchange with other people. I'm convinced that in the theater, the live medium, that the last member of the company to be cast is the audience. Because that is what the exchange really is the audience and the actors and how the audience relates and how they can be excited or bored or whatever, but there is some give and take between the stage and the people viewing it. Art, you know, it's a hard one because, there have been some, we have such a dreadful history of painters of exceptional caliber and artistry who paint and no one, they see it, they don't buy it. I mean, Van Gogh and Cezanne, one sold one, one sold none, I think. And it's not a question of money. I suppose it's a question of some sort of appreciation of something that you've done. It's a hard one. I mean, you'd like it as a visual person, that if you do something and people like it, that's a plus. I mean, you sort of do it for yourself. You try to make an image which is of interest to you, but you'd like it to be of interest to other people because, like E.M. Forster said, only connect. I mean, that is what human beings have to do, is only connect, I think. We'll see.
Thank you very much for taking part in this.
Richard, it's been delightful, and you asked the right questions, and you're a very sympathetic listener, and you're sort of there with me, you know. It's like we're writing this thing together. This was good.